Michelangelo, how's it going?
I'm good, man. How are you? It's good to catch up.
Oh man, I'm good, man. Yourself, what's new?
Well, so we're busy. I've got a couple of very exciting projects which we're going to talk about. But just studio life, man. Just getting in, working with the artists, working with the writers, and just doing our best to create some phenomenal work.
I hear that, man. I think I met you. It would have been, I think, on Twitter about 10 years ago.
Oh, for real? I
Yeah.
can't.
Time flies. And then I think I met you in person at
Yeah.
Tao Yar Studios, I think in 2015, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember. I remember.
So for those who don't know, where did your story begin?
Well, that's a great question. Basically, I mean, from a musical standpoint, it started as early as 5 years old. I started playing trumpet in school, only because my best friend at the time was playing it, so I started playing it too. And then he quit, and I kind of just kept going. Fast forward, I got a scholarship, probably about 10 years old, to go to this like specialist music school on a Saturday called the Center for Young Musicians. I don't even know if it still runs these days, but it was. I got some great tuition, so I started trumpet and piano over there. Did that pretty much up until a teenager. I took a few years kind of out of music. Was just, kids like to play sports and all the other stuff. And then
The sports.
I played a bit of football, but mostly basketball, to be honest. I just used to really, really enjoy it. But I started to, about 16, started to really get into music production. I was quite interested in it. Didn't have any equipment, didn't have any experience, but I was just interested in it. I've always had this like super intimate relationship with music. Like, just always when I heard certain songs, it would literally do something to my physiology. Like, it would change my brainwaves. It was really deep. Certain songs just would put me in like certain states. It was almost like a meditative state as a child. Sometimes like out of body, just listening to certain songs. It was crazy. So I ended up doing a degree, a jazz degree on trumpet. And then I used that money I got from the university, at student loan. I started buying equipment with it, and built a little home studio at my house. And that was really the beginning of learning production just on YouTube, looking at all the great producers of that era. So you're talking Timbaland, Pharrell Williams, Brian Michael Cox, Dark Child, all those guys, looking at what they were doing, recreating a lot of their music. I did as many as 50 Timbaland tracks. I just would recreate all his tracks, and Pharrell, so all the Neptune stuff, I just recreate it all, because my philosophy then, and I still kind of stand by it, but the proof is in the pudding, and that old saying. And if you really recreate something, you reverse engineer it. So you understand about habits, about taste, about certain sounds, how certain sounds fit together. And it just gives you an education, I believe, on production. And once you start doing multiple producers, all of a sudden, when you start creating your own work, you're blending all these different ideas from all these different great producers, and eventually it starts formulating into, your own identity over the time.
That's interesting. All right. So, which components would you say are most apparent in Timberland's material?
Which components? Well, his was definitely rhythm and the sonic. So it was the weight of the drums, for example, how hard the drums hit. And the rhythms, the counter rhythms that he would use, was so unique and so different. And that's really what set him apart. And then on top of that, he had a very interesting sound selection with a lot of the, Middle Eastern sounds that he would use, and blend them together in just very creative ways, which at that time, was brand new, right? We hadn't heard anyone really combine sounds in the way that he did. So that was what really stuck out to me about his production, and they were some of the lessons that I was trying to pick up from studying his material.
And for else.
Pharrell was definitely chordal structure, so it was definitely the chord changes, the voicings in the chord changes, his rhythm as well too was exceptionally unique, but very different. from Timbaland. He would use more organic sounding drums. Even if they were sampled, they were like live snares a lot of the time, that he would use that were resampled through the ASR10. That
Okay.
was like his main sampler keyboard that he used pretty much for every single track that the Neptunes and Pharrell did during that era. I'm not sure if he still uses it now, but so it was definitely just the musical element, I think, which is what I borrowed the most, I think, from my education of studying all of their material. And I would do it like a crash course as well. So I would spend like 4 weeks just literally recreating so many Timbaland songs, must have been about 50. And then another 4 weeks just crash course in Pharrell. So it was like all of a sudden, you know, I'm a fast learner when I'm overexposed to certain situations. I mean, I even learned to drive like that. I did a crash course because I understand that the way my brain works, I like to get fully immersed,
Into it.
so immersed that, you know, I almost lose track of reality a little bit, you know, because I'm just so into it and so like really looking at all the finer details and trying to interpret all the finer decisions that they made to try and understand why, because the why is really like what drives, you know, the decision making. So you think, okay, well, why would they choose to use that certain snare there? Or, you know, what is the purpose of that counter rhythm against, you know, the kick drum, for example, or whatever it was. So that was always the quest for me, and that was where I picked up the foundation of my knowledge.
That's interesting you mentioned seeing it that way, because I think to master anything, you have to look at it almost ironically, right? So as a consumer, you consume the entire thing. As a creative, right, you have to work out, as you said, the why. Why would somebody use that, right? Why would somebody put this and that together? And once you work that out, it stops being unattainable. That makes sense.
Yeah, that is
You
true.
know what I'm
I mean,
saying?
yeah, I would say that, you know, what they did was, you know, it's a product of their own mind, their own, you know, timing of their era. And
Yeah.
for me, the reason was because I wanted to understand more why I would make my own decisions. You know, there's so many decisions you could make in life in general, but especially in production, you know, there's so many different sounds. There's so many different kick drums or, you know, different things that you could do. So I wanted to try and start my production career by with some foundation of understanding why, okay, why did the best people at this time do things a certain way? And, you know, it definitely reinforces my decisions even today. You know, it makes me really think about the purpose, the reason, the intent behind decision, create decision making. And I think that is what would separate, you know, the great producer from the average producer is someone who thinks a lot more deeply about their decisions. And ultimately, all decisions need to point towards feeling, right? Like you have to make the correct decisions to make, in my opinion, are the creative decisions that have the best feeling for the totality of the music. So it's not always about the best decision for what's best just for the kick drum alone. Everything is connected in the song, in the production, in the music, in the vocal. Everything is connected. So you have to be able to view your music and be able to develop a critical thought process in order to truly understand how to generate as much feeling from every single sound that you have in your track. And I think once you understand that is like your roadmap, all of a sudden you'll start and you start putting that into practice over time. You may realize that people begin to connect to your music a lot more because you're installing feeling into that kick drum, you know, whether it's via its placement, and that could be rhythmically or it could be sonically. And there's so many different ways to look at it, but it's all geared towards increasing and injecting strong amounts of feeling into the sounds and into the composition as a whole.
100%. That's a really good point, actually. So it's not just making music for making music's sake, but to link or to make sure that everything that you do is intentional.
Yeah, but I mean, feeling, a good feeling comes from being happy or feeling happy. And so you have to be able to enjoy your process, you know. If your process is if your process is one where you're really enjoying it, you're playful in your manner, in your approach to production, that's going to come across. That feeling that you're holding in within the process is going to be injected into the music. So that's how I personally look at it. You know, I've had a quite a long career already. I've been doing production for over 15 years, and you know, just like any career, any cycle, every career has cycles, and you may find yourself, you know, going through a patch where maybe you, for whatever reason, and there could be many, where maybe you start learning to forget how to enjoy the process. And I think that's the great thing always with beginners, is that, you know, everyone in the music industry is self-selected. No one forces us to come and work in the music industry. It's within us, right? We want to do it. And I think a lot of you know, managing your career, if you're someone who wants to have a long career in the music industry, is learning how to manage your process in terms of the fulfillment and the enjoyment, the curiosity that you have when you're creating music, so that no matter what's happening, you know, in the business side of the music industry or personal life, you can always turn up to your process of creating in a way where you're grateful, but you really appreciate and enjoy that process. And I think that's the key, especially as, you know, producers start getting into the industry. Depends on what kind of career you have, where, you know, sometimes the business side of this industry can, you know, be detrimental in your creativity. And a lot of this career is about protecting, developing, mining your own creativity, but then having the wits to protect your creativity. And that means just really making sure that you're present and you're really enjoying your process, whenever you sit down. So whether it's to write a song, whether it's to produce, whether it's to sing, if you're the artist, whatever it is, whether you're a musician, whatever you choose to do, enjoying the craft is the biggest message I could always give anyone who's creative, because that will always keep you going no matter what's happening on the outside.
100%. So you mentioned you've had a career that's over 15 years now, right?
Yeah.
So can you name some of the artists you've worked with?
So, I mean, my most notable work that I've done was on Sam Smith. I worked on In the Lonely Hour. I did a song called Restart, which was nominated. The album, sorry, was nominated for two Grammys. We won one of them. We were up for Album of the Year, but we didn't win that one. But that's the biggest, most well-known artist I've worked with. But outside of that, a lot of artists in the UK. I've worked with everyone from Jacob Banks, Wes Nelson, Ella Eyre. I've worked with Sigala. I've worked with so many artists. I mean, it's, you know, I like to work with a lot of independent artists, a lot of new artists. I've noticed for me personally that I have really good results helping to break new artists, helping them to find an identity, and take them to that next level. I really believe like that's what my calling was to do. So I've never really chased a lot of the big artists. I've just working with a lot of new artists, and then they turn out to be big artists. You know, for example, the Sam Smith thing, you know, it was at the beginning of his career, and the Lonely Album was his first album. And at the time when I was working with him, when we were making those records, you know, he wasn't famous yet. I think he may have just done Latch, for Disclosure, but you know, he wasn't famous. He was getting the bus. People didn't know who he was yet. So, you know, I've always had a really good record with working with young artists, new artists. I've done a lot of work internationally, in Sweden, and a lot of work over in Scandinavia, and then in America also. So I'm predominantly based in the UK. I feel like my contributions to music, I wanted to focus those efforts in the UK. I know a lot of UK producers who, you know, choose to leave the UK and go out to the USA for so many reasons and do exceptionally well. But I wanted to keep my talent at home and to help the UK music market become bigger and greater than it's ever been.
Interesting. Okay, so with Sam Smith, right? How did that working relationship begin? Did you get an invitation to work with him? How did
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly it. So basically, I was working with a DJ called Zane Lowe, who at that time was still
Just
at
say
Radio
no.
One.
Just say no.
Yeah, well, I mean, Zane's he's a master at what he does, and he's so much more than just being a radio DJ. He's an incredible writer, he's an incredible producer, he has so many great creative ideas. I learned so much about learning how to produce an artist from Zane Lowe, not necessarily the stuff where you're sitting at the computer, but he was great at being able to relate to the artist, helping the artist to find their point of view. He was great in that area. So I started working with him originally as just an engineer. And then we just developed a really, really great relationship. He really, liked me, and I think my expertise and what I brought to the room always brought energy, brought professionalism, brought a high quality of engineering, recording vocals, and support. Whatever I needed to do on that day, if he asked me, I'd get it done just to make sure that we could get that record where it needed to be. I was very committed to just creating a high quality product at the end of the day. So I worked with him. That relationship lasts for well over 3 years. We worked together on and off. And there was so many artists that would come by through to the studio that we were working with. And then one day I got the booking, and it was Sam Smith. And we did 2 days, I believe, with Sam Smith. We did two songs. There was another song which I absolutely loved also that didn't make the album, didn't quite fit. But the one that we did Restart was the one that made the project. And even at that time, to be honest, when Sam Smith came in, he would say, "My album's done, my album's done." He was very happy with the body of work that he'd done already. I think almost at the beginning of the session, it felt like, we were just kind of there just to write, not really sure if there was even a possibility of having it make a project. But, when you just put your heart and soul into something, I think the chemistry was just right on that day, and we ended up creating a record which was a single on the album also. I think it was maybe a fourth or fifth single for the album. So yeah, it was a great moment in time, and I had no idea at that time that what we were doing was going to be historic. It's the biggest album of the last decade, and just one of the greatest moments, I think, in music for the UK that we've had from a new artist, probably since Adele. So yeah, it was a great project to be a part of.
That's interesting. So when he came to the, sorry, when they came to the studio, right, they realized, so they told you that the album was done.
Well, he said that. Yeah, I think he said it about three times, because I remember sitting there thinking, "Oh, okay, so how, what's going to be the outcome?" You don't really know. But one thing I've learned is never judge books by their covers. And a lot of what our job is to do is to shine a light on the artist that day. We want to create something that's going to be a light that's so bright that it's going to be hard to deny, no matter what people say coming in. And, just being very patient, not being judgmental about what he's saying. There was no kind of conflict or debate about any of it. Like, we would sit and take his word, as his word, and just trust that what we could do, would be just an evolution of what he has. It would have to be an evolution in order for him to want to incorporate it into his body of work, because no doubt his body of work was absolutely fantastic already before he came. So, our job is to bring something different, to help him find another angle which reflects who he is as an artist, which he doesn't have yet, which he would want. And you have to be able to do that before they would even know that they'd want it, if that even makes sense. So it's you have to be quite forward thinking in your approach, and you have to really trust your talent. Like, just trust your talent to show up when you need it the most. It will be there. And that takes a lot of faith. Sometimes there can be a lot of nerves and all this kinds of stuff. But you just have to be patient and trust yourself, trust that talent, and like really put it to the test. I actually challenge anyone listening to this who creates anything, but put yourself in those positions where your back slightly up against the wall, like with finding opportunities, and just trust your talent wholeheartedly. And you know what? If it doesn't work, then maybe it just wasn't meant to be. But we trust ourselves 110%. And in those moments, when it matters, when it counts, our talent shows up for us.
Amazing. So, how much of his record, if any at all, did you hear before you started making Restart?
That's a great question, actually. To be honest, I mean, we might have heard one or two things, but it's not like he sat and played us half the album. I just kind of remember, we might have heard a few bits, but Zane Lowe, who I was working with, came prepared. So he brought like the idea of Restart. I think he might have made it. I can't remember if he said on the train or in the car. I'm probably in the car somewhere, but he'd made it just quickly that day, I'm pretty sure, like in the morning. So he had like the kind of quote unquote bare bones of Restart. And he was like, okay, what do you think of this? And so I played it. We did the session in my studio. I played it off the speakers, and the fundamental aspects of the track were great. And then the Zane, like I said, was great with working with the artists and just created a vibe. I think a lot of it is the music, but I think a lot of it is the experience that the artist has with you when they come to work with you, and he just created, and he's the one that taught me how to just create an experience for the artist that really makes it impactful, because then they'll tie the song
The
to
feeling,
that
yeah,
experience
I've seen
and
that.
it sticks in the memory. It sticks, a lot longer. People will remember more of it, right? Just it's almost becomes more real. So that's what happened. And then they basically started top lining. I was adding a few elements on the keys and stuff. And then I recorded Sam when he was ready to do it. And yeah, it just came out great, super easy to record, amazing voice. In terms of vocal production, I didn't have to do much. He's that good. He's just that good that I didn't have to do much. And as a producer, vocal production is so important. Production nowadays in general is so much more than what production used to be 10, 15 years ago. Because there are still beat makers, of course, like the guys that just want to make a beat and send it, and that's as far as they want to take production. But for a producer who's well-rounded and works in the studio with artists from scratch or from very minimal ideas, you've got to be able to do it all. The vocal production, if the vocal production was terrible, he would have it would have subtracted from his experience of that session and his love of the song. So as the producer, you're responsible for what people hear coming out of the speakers. So you have to give 110% to all areas. That includes mix, that includes vocal production, and all of these things, because they will either add or subtract from the artist's love of the product that you're creating. And, the music industry is basically, quote unquote, commission based, right? I mean, you may do a publishing deal if you're lucky. So you're given money to turn up and write and create, right? And then that publishing company will have a percentage of your publishing. But day to day, this is a commission-based industry. In other words, people don't get paid unless you create things which people, the artists who are coming in, absolutely love, or their team, whether they've got a label, absolutely love. So it's absolutely critical that people love what you do. And when you're starting out, that won't be the case. So you have to develop yourself to the point where people come in with you and love, genuinely love what they do. And so that includes, developing the skills for vocal production, developing the skills for mix, all of these other skills which maybe wouldn't have been so important 15 years ago or whatever, now are more important than ever. And we have the technology now more than ever to do that. 15 years ago, it was very different. Technologically speaking, it was much harder to mix 15 years ago because there weren't as many plugins. There was very little plugins. Everything was analog. That means you had to buy all the analog equipment and it would just cost a fortune. So the time now is very different and we have all the tools at our disposal to be able to mix. So it's very important for all producers out there to take vocal production mix very seriously and all the other elements around just making the beat. It's very important.
And how does producing tracks vocally differ from making the beats? Obvious question, but it's worth asking.
Can you be more specific?
For example, can someone be a vocal producer without having any involvement with actual production of the track?
Well, you can be a beat maker. You can just make a beat and send it out. A lot of people like to work like that. And then hope that whoever you're sending it to, there's a great songwriter and a really good artist, and then hope to get your break that way. I think that's definitely a strong American tradition, although of course not all American producers work that way. It just depends what side, what you want to do personally. For me, I love to be in engaging with the writers and the artists. I like to be there leading the room. That's my bag. That's my skill set, I think. And that's how I've chosen to approach it. So in that case, vocal production, mix, that kind of stuff is really, really important. But if you're just making a beat, then yeah, okay, you will never have to worry about vocal production. But then, unless you're in a studio and have an engineer, how are you ever going to record vocals that sound great? What if the artist and the writer, what if you send them a beat and then they send you back the vocal stems and you can't mix it? Then you're going to have to send it to someone else to mix. I think the key is a lot of the labels and a lot of the entities of power in the industry, they're looking for the creatives that are almost like one-stop shops. So, they want to be able to send their developing artist to you, and they're going to want that artist to come back with a record that sounds as complete as you can possibly make it. And you're not going to be able to do that if you don't learn the other skill set.
Interesting. So you mentioned Sam Smith, obviously. We're talking about Sam. So at that time, I remember, right? You'd have, let's say, Sam Smith, you'd have Ed Sheeran, James Arthur. What is it about the UK and its ability to develop really strong adult contemporary artists? Because
It's a great question. I think it's cultural. I think part of it is just cultural. I think London is so diverse, and I think the level of life experience in London can be so diverse. The art is really just the reflection of the humanity and the people that create it. So, the fact that we are able to have, quite relatively diverse lives, I think that adds to the talent. I just think we have a natural skill in music. If you could go way back and you look at the Beatles or you look at, all of these English legends, right? Or even just from the UK, it could be Wales and Scotland as well. Like, just our region has something special. I do believe that the UK is one of the top breeding grounds for international music, and we have it. So, the cream always rises to the top, and I think that the artists who are truly supposed to make it absolutely will make it, because they have the tenacity. And I think that a lot of the artists that I've met here in the UK, that the best ones, they have that tenacity. Even though they have success, they're still hungry. They're constantly refining their skill set, their voice, their ability to write. I was working with an artist just last week, amazing artist, UK artist called Wes Nelson.
Oh, nice.
And he's really successful, but he's trying to take things even further to that next level, And we did an amazing record, and he was so happy, and it was a great experience for all of us. And I'm sure you guys will be hearing that song in the next few months. And but his skill set, he's a great example that not only is he an amazing singer, but he's also an amazing vocal engineer. He can engineer vocals himself. You know, he can Melodyne. He knows all the software, and he's literally as good as any, almost any engineer that would do that job. So it just shows you, and he's still learning new skills, you know. So it just shows you that the best guys are not just singers, but you know, a lot of them are. The evolution of the artist now is being able to engineer your own vocals because of technology, and just the fact that, you know, technology allows us to be able to bridge gaps where we couldn't bridge them before. In other words, distance. So if some, you know, if someone sends him a beat, he could not only write the song, but he could engineer it, record it, and he'll send you back. Yeah, he'll send you back a vocal which is ready for radio, you know. So it just shows you the highest level of what people are striving for in terms of skill sets and talent.
Amazing. So when it comes to Wes, where's he going now musically?
So he got so many songs, you know, he showed me hundreds of songs on his computer and played me some absolute bangers, absolute bangers. So when me as a producer, when I hear all that, I'm like, okay, you know, that's great. But I'm never going to try and replicate like a song that you have. I'm not a huge believer in trying to repeat. First of all, what I've done or what you've done, we need this is a unique meeting on a unique day, and I want to make something which is represents that. So we decided to go in a more commercial route. He's growing, you know, he's still growing as an artist, and I believe the you know, his intent is to grow into more of a commercial lane because he has a voice for it, he has a look for it, and understanding that certain genres can only take you so far sometimes. So I believe you'll see a more mainstream, commercially, internationally viable version of Wes Nelson. And he's that already, but I think he's growing into an even better version of that. And I'm sure you'll see it soon.
I'm looking forward to it. Now, you mentioned that labels are interested, for example, in signing an artist, then sending them over to someone like yourself, for example, who help them develop their sound, develop what they are going to do, then go back to the label, who then releases them, right? How recent has that shift been? Has that always been the case with producers?
Well, from what I've been told just recently, the labels are actually restructuring and going back to a model of really focusing on development, excuse me, for artists, new artists. So, for example, we'll take Universal. They've restructured recently, and now they're focusing on, you know, developing acts again, which we haven't really seen for, you know, maybe 10 years, or maybe more,
I
you
say about
know.
20 years.
Yeah, exactly.
I
So,
think last time we saw it developed, the last like class, yeah, I think would have been the like Jessie J, Lady Gaga, Katy Perry.
yeah,
Maybe,
exactly.
and then maybe, yeah, I think, and then Drake, yeah, I think that was like, so anyone who debuted after 2010 maybe was developed.
Yeah, well, you have to develop yourself these days. But now it's they're going back to that old model, so it's great for you know being a new artist now. All of a sudden, if the right people can just hear your music, you'll get a development deal for a couple of years where the label will pay for everything, and it will be this intense development structure where you're constantly writing with a producer and a writer until you find the right match. You know, because obviously there's different forms and of creativity and. Everyone likes to work slightly differently. So you've got to find the people that have the chemistry and understand the vision that you have as an artist. So I would say now that the labels are very focused on that, and that's going to be the growing trend, I believe, for the next 5 years at least, where you're going to start seeing some really developed artists come back. Because maybe, you know, there hasn't been a new artist who's broken through this year. At an international level, there hasn't been what no one's broken artists this year, you know, and it's kind of showing you that this is why the labels are going back to the development because they're not doing any development. So we're not seeing any new artists who are at a certain very high level, which, you know, labels kind of had just focused on scalability for the last 10, 15, 20 years. So they'll wait to find an artist that has already done the development. They'll know that it works. They'll know that that artist, you know, is able to sell records and get streams. And then they all the label would do from that point, once an artist is already self-proven or proven that their model works creatively, the labels just scale up. The At labels, it's all about scalability. They just scale up what already works and take it to an international audience, so to speak. But now they want to do more development. And I think it's a great thing for the culture. It's a great thing for music. It's a great thing for the arts. And it's a great thing to be a producer and a writer again, because it definitely gives you confidence as a creative to know that, you know, the labels are focusing and investing on developing new artists, because then it you understand that the infrastructure that's needed to take something from 0 to 100 is going to be there. And that gives you a lot of confidence going into rooms working with a lot of these artists.
100%. There was a period in 2015, I believe, yeah. They were going on social media and decided that if someone had maybe, I don't know, 500,000 followers, if that, I think maybe even less, you know, right? Just sign them. But the problem is that social media followers don't convert into music fans, right? And so I think what's interesting now, what's great to hear about this new system we're talking about is the fact that as much as, for example, social media is a great tool to find new artists, right? You can't guarantee that someone with 1 million followers will be a great musician or even sell records to. And so,
That's
as far as development, as far as what you're hearing, right? Where are they looking for artists? Do you know?
well, yeah, at one point it was only TikTok.
Right.
But you're absolutely right. I mean, I've worked with, you know, I don't want to put anyone's business out in the street, but I've worked with a lot of quote unquote actors from like reality TV shows that have that million followers and want to, you know, try and cross over into the music. And, you know, have never been in the studio before, you know, haven't refined their talents, and it doesn't work. You know, their followers, who saw them on whatever TV show they were on, do not care about the music. So you're absolutely right. I think, you know, ultimately, I think people are looking at Spotify. So if I was an independent artist at the moment, I would definitely have self releases on Spotify. You know, music supervisors are looking on Spotify to find new music if they need it, or it's been sent to them via a label. So I think the key is just Spotify. I think if you're an artist now and you're making your own music, definitely get consistent releases up online, even if you don't have much money to promote it, but just release all your own music regularly and just make sure that it's as high a quality as possible, and that it represents you and the parts of you which are interesting to the audience. And I think if you can do that, you'll be discovered pretty soon.
Interesting. And last year we worked together on an artist called Banner, right? Really gifted. And so how did that come about?
I was introduced to her via a producer friend that I know. And yeah, I mean, it was, you know, the girl's got talent. She's representing a different culture, and it's all quite new to the West. So she definitely has a voice. She definitely has a story, and you know, she's great to work with in the studio.
Amazing, amazing. Now, if you had to describe your sound in a sentence, what would it be?
In one, just one sentence,
Just the one.
a life's work worth of skills in one sentence.
What is it?
I would say honest. I feel like my sound, whatever sounds I'm using, is to point the audience towards getting to know that artist in a more honest and unique way. You know, I see my sound as being able to bridge the gap, right, between the audience and the artist. whatever that sound may sound like. You know, I work on every genre almost of music. So, you know, I'm not locked in to just hip hop and R&B. So all my stuff doesn't sound as kind of the same. But my sound is, that's the one key thing that I'm really trying to do when I sit there in front of that keyboard and computer. So that's the best way to describe it, I think.
So, are there instances, for example, when an artist is cautious about being honest? And in those cases, how does the push to kind of get it out of them?
That's a great question. Cautious about being honest. Yeah, I mean, sometimes you may have like certain artists from certain territories, and you know, they might try to sing like they sound from a different territory. And you know,
Right.
I always encourage whoever I'm working with to just be themselves. You know, I always start my sessions with conversations about their life, about what they're going through, about who they are. Firstly, because I don't know who they are, because I've just met them. And secondly, because that is whatever they say in response to those questions, that is where I want to start the foundation for whatever we're going to create. That's where my understanding starts. You know, every session with every different person is always so different because everyone, you know, I try to understand the individual's story first. And that's what will lead and inspire my creative decisions. So, I think a lot of the time, if people don't want to be themselves, it's or show themselves or show any vulnerabilities, usually there's some sort of fear attached to that. Maybe, you know, they've had criticism in the past, or maybe they just, you know, self-esteem. Maybe they just don't believe that who they truly are and what skill sets they have. Are good enough, you know, and so my job is to always redirect the artist back to, you know, their most honest version of who they're capable of becoming, and it usually works out sonically really well if I focus on that.
And is that common where artists don't often feel as though who they are is as good as who they want to be? Because obviously there's the human being and the persona, right? How difficult is it for artists to bridge the two?
It depends and it can vary. I think if you're comfortable, or I think it's about learning to get more comfortable with the real you, you know. The more comfortable you can make the artists being their like real selves, like so telling us a story about something which is personal that they went through that, you know, they wouldn't just tell a stranger and yet we've only just met them. Helps them to be more comfortable in their own life experiences, and you know, not being afraid to talk first. Because what, in my experience, what I've learned is, if someone is scared to open up in a conversation, I'm never going to get the best out of them when they sing. They're never going to fully commit to singing the song if they can't fully commit to even having a conversation with me. So I will, you know, ask questions. I will try and basically dig for bits of information that reveal how they really feel about their lives and what, you know, what experiences they're going through at their time. I think that stuff is really important. I almost begin my sessions as like a therapist, kind of, where it's, you know, it's just could be just conversation for an hour. We might not even listen to any music yet. I just want to figure out, you know, who and what I'm working with and what they're going through. And that always encourages people to gravitate more towards who they truly are if they're able to talk about who they truly are and what they're truly going through. And that's really where it starts.
Which is important because the studio should be a safe space, right?
Absolutely.
That's interesting. So it does make sense hearing the way you work, seeing why labels do send artists to you, especially when they're developing, because they know that beyond getting music, you're also going to leave with an artist who is far more in touch with who they really are by the time they leave.
Yeah.
Right, so speaking of, right, are there any new artists you're working with currently you really excited about?
That's a great question. So I definitely split my time. I think sometimes it can be 50-50 working with established artists. So that would be like the Wes Nelson, Alakai Harley. I've had singles out with her in the past that have done exceptionally well. And we're doing, some new stuff. Ella Eyre, I produced on her last album as well. With Sigala. So, I'm doing some new stuff for her new album. So I kind of focus 50% of the time on that. And then I discuss with my publishers, Taiyo Music, about potential artists that we could work with. There's a new girl group, two girls called Two Tone, which are great. They're kind of a bit in the same lane-ish as Flo.
Nice.
Exceptionally talented, super young, been friends since, early in school, that kind of great relationship between them. Amazing voices. They can sing incredibly well. And they know who they are,
Right.
even as young artists, they understand what kind of group they want to be and they're committed to it. And that's a great foundation point for anyone coming into a project to be able to see and kind of dive into. So they're excellent. I just like to keep my options open and I'm always meeting new artists. I might spend 2 days a week, with different artists each week, just trying a bunch of new people. So my eyes are always open. So anyone listening to this, just send me a DM on Insta and let me hear some stuff and we can get in and write.
Now you mentioned Tayard Music, right? For those who don't know, what is Tayard?
So Taiyard is a collection of many companies, but they have an incredible studio facility, like a complex in King's Cross in London. And they also have a publishing company, which I'm signed to and have been signed to previously. And they also have like a label and they have a management company. They have all sorts of companies under the Taiyard umbrella. So if you haven't heard of them, you should definitely check them out. They even have an education system. It's basically like a degree for producers, production degree. I'm not sure if they have a master's, they might, but it's an incredible, incredible place. And it's like a channel for new talent, So there's so many talented producers coming through here. It's both established and brand new. So I love that balance and it's just a great place to be if you to meet new talent and just people in the business in general.
It's a great space. I know someone, actually mentored someone who was working with, they have a program there, I forgot what it's called, right? But new talent goes there, for example, and it's not quite established. So they paired this artist with some guys from Hypnosis who were based. So they brought me on and so I saw firsthand how Beyond Housing producers and writers, they really do take time to not only develop, but just support and mentor emerging talent. This is a really good place to be.
Yeah, definitely.
So you've been there for how many years now?
Well, I first started working with Taiyo back in 2013, so it's a long time ago. And I worked with them up till 2018. So we did 5 years. And then I signed with BMG and worked with some other publishers and then COVID. So since post-COVID, basically, I've come back. So I've been back now 6 months. And we've done a new deal. So it's just a great place to be and they really understand me. I think it's important for any producer or songwriter to build a team of people around you who just truly understand who you are, what you're capable of doing, really believe in what you're doing and are patient and understand the kinds of sessions and the kinds of artists that you would do well with. Because like I said, it's about chemistry. So I feel like I have that team here and they do a great job.
Amazing. So you're published. If someone's looking for a publishing deal, right, or they're considering it, which things or what things should they be looking out for? That's what.
Well, I think first of all, you need to have a strong collection of songs. I think I had about 400 songs before I did my first deal. So you need to really build a solid catalog of songs first. The more songs you write, the more chance you have of having songs which end up on the radio or in the chart or streaming well on Spotify, etc., going viral. So you need to write as many songs as possible, work with as many people as possible, be great to work with, have great relationships, and just continue to do your own thing. And if you do that, if you're lucky and you have a song which does exceptionally well, the deal, publishing deal you'll be offered will be of a high value. If not, then if you do get a publishing deal, it'll be more of a development deal, which is less value, but maybe more focused in terms of helping to build up your talent, to the point where you're capable of having songs on the radio. So I think that's where it all really starts. And depending on what happens, whether you get a high value deal or a development deal, would then teach you what to look for in terms of partners. But I think ultimately you just want a team which, excuse me, are committed to helping you take the next step, helping you to evolve your career, focusing on getting you the best high quality sessions possible, and just the patient team that are just really enthusiastic. That's what it is. At the end of the day, it's not necessarily all about the contract. It's about the people that you're going to be working with, and I think that's what a lot of people don't think about.
Interesting. And I've also heard of admin deals, right? How do admin deals work?
Admin deals, to my knowledge, I mean, I've never had a admin deal, but
Right.
essentially it would just be a small percentage to a publishing company to basically collect your royalties. And that can range anywhere, I think, from like 2% to 5%, just depending on how much catalog you have and how many songs you have that are generating money, etc. I think some of the biggest guys that just do admin deals, like the most successful producers, I think their admin deals are just like 1%.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Okay. Now you mentioned a group called Two Tone, and I am observing labels to see how they respond to flow, because flow is massive, right? We know that, for example, when one label, sorry, when an artist does well, other labels observe and see, okay, how can we develop something similar to kind of reach the same audience, right? And so with Two Tone, how would you describe their sound as you're developing it?
So I would describe them as like a strong classic R&B, so classic 90s R&B foundation in their music. I think that's the main component, but then with a spin, so quirky, drawing on, it could be like R&B melody and chord, but then with like a garage drum. Do you know what I mean? So it's like an evolution of the classic 90s R&B in a fun, cool, and uplifting way. And I think that's what separates them.
That's amazing. Amazing. So, Michael, where can someone find you if you're looking for you online?
So guys, check me out on Instagram, my Michelangelo Hits. Find me there. I'm mainly on Instagram. I'm always listening to new music. Happy to chat with any aspiring artists, and I'm always posting updates on my next releases. I've got some more interviews coming, and some new music coming out that I'm super excited about. Also been doing music on a really high profile movie, which I can't talk about just yet, but that's been an exciting and amazing
That's amazing.
experience. And just a lot of new music in the pipeline. So I will definitely post all updates on there, and I'm happy to chat with anyone who's listening who has questions.
All right. So before you go, you mentioned a movie. Yeah. All right. So don't tell me what it's called or what it's about. However, for those who don't know, how does synchronization work for film? So, for example, you're a musician, your song's been used in a film. How does that work generally?
So it can work a number of ways. You can either be asked or find an opportunity to write for a specific movie, or I've had it the other way where I've just made songs I've made in the past have just been selected To be in movies or TV or adverts. I've had a couple of like global adverts. The most recent one a couple of years ago with Estee Lauder, which had Amanda Gorman feature on our track that I made, which was just everywhere. I just saw that advert absolutely everywhere. I traveled, I'd see it all in the airports, I'd see it in TV. It just was a worldwide one. And so that was an old song that I'd done that they used. So it really depends. But if you have a publisher or a music supervisor, if you're able to get your music to those types of people, they're able to submit your music to, a variety of companies or brands looking for particular types of music. And I think that's probably, well, that's the way it happened for me. And it's probably the most viable way to get your music into movies, film, TV, etc.
That's amazing. Well, Michael, it's been great talking to
Yeah, likewise, man. Thank you for the opportunity and just for all the creatives out there. Keep going, keep striving, enjoying what you're doing, and your opportunities will come. So don't doubt yourselves. Just keep going. And thank you, David. I really enjoyed it, mate.
you.
And let's catch up soon.
Definitely, bro. All right, talk soon, yeah.
See you, man.
That's
Bye.
it. Bye.